the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
So to begin, well, the sun is sizzling, the schools are shut and the suitcase is calling. Yes, summer is in full swing. While the rest of us are plotting picnics or packing the paddling pool, did you ever wonder what the fabulously wealthy spend their holidays doing? Well, the answer involves private castles, helicopters on standby, lavish surprises and perfectly planned little details. My first guest runs a luxury travel agency that's rolled out the red carpet for the likes of Taylor Swift and Kim Kardashian. Siobhan Byrne of Adams and Butler. You're very welcome. You're a keen traveller yourself, Siobhan, and not just the luxury kind. Where did your love of travel come from?
Well, I was the youngest of four siblings and there is a gap of 13 years. So at the age of 3 and 4, I used to be dragged by my parents in a trailer tent over to France and Spain because my two elder sisters went to school for a year in Carcassonne in the south of France. We would have driven all the way down through different, you know, camping sites. And my father worked for Irish Shipping, so we got a free passage on the ferries. And we did that every year. So I sort of was used to mixing with other cultures and, you know, being hosted by families, etc. And I suppose the love of that and the excitement, you know, of meeting new people every year, even as a young child, was really thrilling.
And I suppose by doing it that way, you are sort of more immersed in the place that you're visiting, aren't you?
Well, you're immersed in the sense of that you're normally staying within a village or within a town. Like, it's not like staying in a hotel. You know, you'd go and you'd meet other people from the country who were travelling and camping around. And I loved playing with other children and learning the naughty words in French and in Spanish. And I actually, to this day, have a very good accent in French and Spanish that I put down to those years spent, running around with the local children.
And what about school then and doing Leaving Cert? Did you know what you wanted to do career-wise or college-wise?
I wanted to be a pilot or an explorer, but the pilot was the main thing that I wanted to do. And I went sort of a different path after I did my Leaving Cert. I studied languages when I left school.
And Leaving Cert is a big year for anyone, but for you, you became a mum at 16, so it would have been a particularly... There was a lot happening and a particularly challenging time.
True. I was pregnant at 16 with my first child and then I did my Leaving Cert and then took a year to have him and then went to college the following September. I used to have to run out of my lectures early to go to the creche to feed him and then run back, you know, for my afternoon classes and then put him on the back of the bicycle and, you know, cycle back home. So it was just something I did, but I used to be exhausted in the evening because, like, I'd put him to bed after dinner and I'd, you know, snuggle in beside him. His name is Jonathan and I'd snuggle in beside him and I'd end up falling asleep myself and, you know, not getting up until the next morning. So, you know, but he was a very good child as well. I was very lucky. You know, I could study in my room with him and he'd be occupying himself playing with toys. There's no videos or anything in those days.
And you decided to study Arabic at university. Why?
I did. So I did, when I was pregnant, I did night classes in Arabic and I also did night classes in typing. And the gentleman who was teaching me was also one of the teachers in the university in UCD. So when I was doing Arabic, he said I had a particularly good aptitude for it. I got first class honours in the first year, which really made me happy because I'm a person who's very competitive. It's one of my downfalls. So I like doing well in things when I set, you know, a target.
Do you think it can be a downfall if you go too hard at it?
Yeah, well, I to be honest, I never go too hard. Like, I got a first class on my MBA and it was like 69.75. So by the skin of my teeth, I got there. But I compete against myself. It's not really against other people. It's really competing against myself.
And that connection with Arabic that you became interested in, was it because of Arabic families you would have met on those trips to France?
It was, exactly, because one of my sisters, Mary, had Algerian friends in the convent where she attended school and they would invite us out. And, like, we were invited out by very wealthy people who lived in, you know, France and in Andorra. But we also were invited out by, you know, families who were more impoverished and they'd large families. And I used to always prefer going to those families because I felt they were more real and authentic. And when I went on to do my master's in Arabic, I actually incorporated some of the Islamic, you know, areas as well in my master's in Arabic.
It was, by modern standards, a very brave thing to do, to say, I love Arabic, I want to learn more about it, I'm going to study this in college. A lot of people today think about university as the job they want to get at the end rather than the thing they want to learn about.
Yeah, what happened with me was, it was a little bit more commercial than that. In those days, you paid fees when you went to university. So you paid a set amount to do a degree in arts. So I could be one of 1,000 people in the French department, or I could be one of 3 in the Semitic language department. So I felt I was getting a better bang for my buck by making the decision to study Arabic.
As long as you got on with the other two, I suppose.
Yeah, true. True. And then I also did Spanish, which was good, you know, because there's a lot of interaction between, you know, history and the cultures with the Islamic Spain, you know, Al-Andalus in the 13th century, etc. So,
and after college, then you went to work in the hotel industry, and moving further on in time, I suppose, when we talk about your own business now, that would have been a very helpful experience to you. You worked in Killiney.
Killiney. I worked in what was officially the Court Hotel, but a lot of people know it as Killiney Court. So when I had finished my degree in Spanish and Arabic, I went on to do a master's. And then I was invited by UCD to do a pilot program of the Diploma in Higher Business Studies, which is sort of for postgrads of other disciplines to learn business. And so if they're going into, say, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, they have a business degree as well as or business qualification as well as their specialization in chemistry or science or whatever. So I did that. And then the Irish Goods Council at the time had a program whereby they put people who were, you know, qualified in marketing or business into companies that didn't have a marketing function or person up until that point. So I was on the program and I was allocated to the Court Hotel in Killiney. And I was very lucky. And I'll tell you why, because when I went to work, the guy who owned, he married into the Evex Buckley family and he owned half the hotel at the time, Niall Kenny, he was an amazing mentor. So they had applied for funding, ERDF funding, to build a conference centre. And I knew that if the Irish presidency was coming up, and it was a great opportunity to get sort of high powered meetings. So I went to the European Foundation and I asked them, would they give us some overflow? And when I was there, I discovered that because Spain, Portugal and Greece had joined the EU, that the language requirement for the European Foundation went from 6 languages up to 9. So this was in 1989, 1990. So they were throwing out their old equipment. So we got that equipment. And the technician there also told me the most important thing to do is talk to the interpreters, because they're the people really who are the backbone of every meeting. If it doesn't work for them, the meeting is not happening. So there's this wonderful woman, Christina Eustace-Werkner, who was head of the Interpreting Association at the time. And she had said that a hotel down in Kerry had built, you know, interpreting booths, but they were under the specification, so they wouldn't use them. So we then built the booths and we actually did it over the specification. And then through her support, the conference centre paid off for itself within 6 months.
So what would you say you learned from that time in the hotel business about hospitality, about dealing with different clients that has stood you well?
Well, we had very wealthy clients who would come in, like, you know, you'd have sort of all the finance ministers, all the health ministers, heads of state coming in, etc., into the hotel. So we learned how to look after them. So, you know, you weren't fazed by important people. The other thing is I learned, you know, how important it is to talk to people, because if it wasn't for the European Foundation giving us advice, if it wasn't for Christina Eustace-Werkner advising us and then us being able to take that advice and us supporting us, you know, that conference centre wouldn't have been so successful and the Court Hotel wouldn't have been so successful.
Round about the time that you were working in the hotel industry, you married. Your husband was Moroccan, French-Moroccan?
Yeah, he was Moroccan, and his father would have been a Berber and his mother would have been Arab. So his mother was from Marrakesh and his father was from a place called Tafraout or Tharoudanth, which is not far from Agadir. I always laugh that my first father-in-law was a bigamist and my second father-in-law was a polygamist, because he had 4 wives at the same time. He was older than I was. He was teaching in UCD. I met him when I was doing the business qualification. Then we married and I had children, like wham bam, thank you ma'am. So 4 boys. And since then I've actually acquired another son. So yeah.
And you mentioned your second father-in-law. He, because your second husband was African. Tell me a bit about that love of Africa that you've developed?
So it actually happened on the very first Christmas that I was married to my first husband, and he went to Morocco. And I was on my own at home with Jonathan, and Out of Africa was playing on the TV, and that I just fell in love with Africa when I saw that film. So the first time I went to Africa was 2006 with my children, and I drove around South Africa and we had an amazing time. And at that case, I was truly bitten by the bug. And then I started selling South Africa to clients. So the company that I own, Adams & Butler, specialises in Ireland, the UK, and also Africa. The people who book us in a lot of the times are travel advisors abroad, and it's their clients then that we look after. So there was a travel advisor in California. She'd booked a client who she'd said had been very difficult until they started traveling with us. They went to Ireland, the UK, France with us, and they went to South Africa, and then they wanted to go to Kenya. And I said, you know, I would love to do this for you, but I don't know anyone in Kenya. So if anything goes wrong, I can't pull the client out. So she got upset, and the next week she rang me and she was full of the joys of living. And I said, wow, did you get, you know, someone to look after them? And she said, yes, I did. And I said, who? And she said, you. And I said, no. We've gone through this before. We can't do it. And she said, I explained to the clients and they want to take you with them. So I went off with the clients and went to Kenya. And one of the properties that I stayed in, my future husband at the time was the head guy, but since a few years later, he became the manager of that property. And he was driving us whilst I was, when I stay in a property, a lot of the time I have to do site inspections and stuff like that. So whilst I was in the Mara in the south of Kenya, I wanted to look at other properties that I was interested in putting clients into. So I asked the owner, you know, could I borrow the driver and could he drive me around the property? So we spent a few hours together. We got on really, really well.
And he was from a particular tribe that had still quite a traditional way of life in terms of just how they lived and family connections. And you spent some time there.
I did. So a lot of people are familiar with the Maasai, the ones, you know, the nice tall gentlemen that jump up and down. So a lot of people are familiar with that tribe. So they have cousins, the Samburu, who live in the north of Kenya. And they're called also the butterfly people. They wear different coloured clothes. They wear sort of orange and yellow. They're more petite. They're smaller. So he was from the Samburu tribe. They live in huts, no bathrooms, no showers and no running water anywhere. So it's quite, you know,
not quite the luxury end of the hotel market, I suppose.
Exactly. Like, you know, you'd have to pee and poo in the bush. A shower, if you were lucky, was a bucket, you know, tied to a tree with holes in it. So I used to go for periods. I could always do 13 weeks. And 13 was sort of like the magic number, because then I would start, literally, I would start drying out. I would get cooked. The harshness and the aridness after 13 weeks, I would have to leave and go back home or go to America for clients or whatever.
So in the middle of the night then, if you needed to use the facilities, there weren't necessarily a whole lot, you'd have to go out.
Well, I used to sneak out at night time and go to the bathroom. And because the thing is that they all seemed to know how to do it, that no one would come along if they were doing anything during the day. But I never mastered that skill. So at night time, when it was pitch dark, I would sneak out and I would go to the bathroom. So a few days later, they called me Dital El Masi, which means the daughter with the long hair, because women normally shave their heads. And I heard, you know, the elders were having a meeting, a council meeting, and all I could hear was Dital Masi, Dital Masi, Dital Masi. So I knew they were talking about me. So I said to my husband, I said, like, what's going on? And he said, they're talking about you sneaking out at night time. So they gave this edict that I would have to, if I was going to the bathroom, go with my husband and he would have to hold my hand. And the reason being, there was a leopard somewhere around because we could see their tracks, and there are hyenas at nighttime, which I mightn't be comfortable dealing with because it can be very aggressive. So after that, I couldn't go out unless he went with me. And we had to obey the rule, because if you don't obey what the sort of sentence is or what they decide, then you're not part of the tribe. So it's a very, you know, hierarchy with the elder, with the, first of all, the main elders, the headman, then the main elders, junior elders, the warriors, etc.
So he'd stand watch.
Exactly. Not the most romantic thing, by the way.
Oh, maybe it's very romantic. Mm. What about your mother-in-law and his family? How were you received by them?
So my mother-in-law, she had a tough life. She had one eye. She'd lost an eye when she was younger, and she was a second wife. So normally the first wife is the strategic wife. And the second wife is, you know, you want another vehicle to carry your children and to produce children because it's a tough life. A lot of children die in stillbirth, etc. And then usually the fourth or third wife is the one that's the pretty young one that keeps the old man full of energy and on his toes. So she wasn't really the favourite wife. So she had a tough time. But she, on the first 3 days, the first time I went to see them when we got married, our tent was put in the middle of the boma. So the boma is an enclosure and there'd be about 4 to 6 huts belonging to different, the huts belong to the women. And each woman would have a hut. So a husband would take it in turns to visit each of the huts that his wives were in. So the wives would have their hut with their children, etc. So she had her hut and she would come over the first 3 days and she gave me boiling water so I could make my coffee, because the one thing I adore is my coffee. So I'd make my coffee. And then on the fourth day, she never came. And I said, I knew something was up. I knew that it meant something, but I didn't know what it was. So eventually she comes over and my husband is there and she's, you know, messing around with the fire. And then I heard her talk, like she was talking in Samburu, but then I heard my name being mentioned again. So I said to Kasai, I said, you know, what's happening? And he said, oh, my mother is telling you to wash her cup. So the first 3 days I was the guest, and on the fourth day I officially became the daughter-in-law, and from then on I would have to do what she told me to do. The honeymoon was over, yes.
And going back to the business that you set up and that you run, Adams and Butler, having worked in the hotel industry, why did you decide, you know, to leave or to go out on your own? Was that something you'd always wanted to do?
Well, when I worked in the hotel, I'd done an awful lot of areas besides the sales and marketing. And I just wanted a title of managing director because I knew, you know, I had the ability. So in the year 2000, I actually was headhunted to run another company. And I went there. And after 1 year there, I actually enrolled for an MBA in Smurfit Business School. And then my thesis for the MBA was the viability of a sort of an e-model for Irish luxury tourism. So I set up a company. So the company is Adams and Butler. And it's like, we use the word DMC, Destination Management Company.
Yeah. And then in setting up the company, inevitably you ended up having a lot of celebrity clients. Who was your first?
The first one was Michael Jackson, and I loved him. We had him for a year and a half.
How did you land Michael Jackson?
So we were the only company at the time, really, who were doing big property rentals like castles and luxury, you know, country estates, etc. So an inquiry came in from our partners in Scotland who did similar things in Scotland, and it came in at the same time from an agent in Florida, a travel agent, and at the same time from the Sultan of Bahrain, so his household. So we did a proposal and we got the booking.
So you landed Michael Jackson. He's in Ireland for what was a pretty prolonged stay. It wasn't just a brief holiday.
Yeah.
So what kinds of things do you need to look after? What do you provide?
Well, he was actually, he was a very easy client. They didn't, they stayed at first in Lugala, which belonged to Gareth Brown, part of the Guinness family, and they looked after them very well. They used just a local person of the estate for security, a regular cleaners, like they weren't high maintenance at all. He used to ring me once a month, and usually on the first of every month, whether it was a Sunday or a Monday. And he would say, Siobhan, this is Michael. I just want to say we appreciate everything you're doing. God bless. And that was literally the total of the conversation. I don't think I even said a word. They were very happy in Ireland. And like things they would do is go to the bookstore in Dorking. We'd have it private for them in the evening so that they could rummage through and look at the books.
Is it difficult to make that happen, Siobhan? Say, look, I want you to open the store, the bookstore, especially this evening. There's an important celebrity coming in.
No, it's not, because that bookstore, like they can go around and tell people. So they're getting benefit from it as well. I remember I had to look for a house one time for Pierce Brosnan for 6 weeks, and the woman wasn't going to charge him because the idea of Pierce Brosnan staying in her house for 6 weeks was getting her all excited.
And sometimes that can make a big difference. Yeah. You've also looked after Taylor Swift. What was she like?
Again, low maintenance. We were very involved in the first time she came. I think it was 2008. And then 2009, there was a drop in the prices of property. So they were trying to sell Luttrellstown Castle. They never managed to sell it. They just had the golf course open. And I remember ringing them and saying, we have a celebrity. They want to have a party in a castle in Dublin. And really, you're the only real castle in Dublin. And they were saying, oh, we can put them in the golf clubhouse. And I said, no. Oh, not that type of client. And then they said, oh, we don't have beds. And I said, well, we'll pay for the beds. You know, whatever you need, we'll pay. But, you know, and then we...
So at what point do you introduce the name of the celebrity into the conversation?
Well, we were very lucky because it's very rare we're asked to do NDAs. But on that time when she travelled, we weren't asked to do an NDA. And it was actually her mother who was involved as well with the booking. So when I got the phone call, I was like, didn't really believe it was Taylor Swift's mother. But it was. I thought friends were having a joke and I was on the radio, you know, and it was a spoof type thing. But they wanted to have Guinness for lunch with all these, you know, teenagers. And I was saying, you'll put them asleep, like, do it, you know, Heineken, have, you know, cider, lighter drinks as well. So, but like, again, low maintenance, no problems.
And what was she like? Was she very nice. As she comes across?
Yes.
In the media?
Very much so. And then we had her a second time, but that time there was more handlers because she was more famous at that stage.
We all saw the coverage of Jeff Bezos's Venice wedding extravaganza. Was that a gig you would have liked to land?
No. We like to almost sort of operate under the radar as such. So like when we have clients or celebrities coming, like Channing Tatum came and we were, you know, told that, you know, they don't want anyone to know he's in Ireland. So we had another name in the hotel. We had arranged him going down to Wells House with his daughter, an Enchanted Forest photo shoot for her. And then he's off the plane, 2 hours in Ireland, gets drunk, gets onto Instagram with a pint of Guinness saying, I love something Ireland, you know. So they come here because they want something different. They want something under the radar. They don't want to be, you know, in the public eye. So that type of, you know, big bash, or like if something is to do with, say, the American football games or, you know, Wimbledon or the Open, we tend to stay away from things like that because they're messy to organise and just concentrate on what we're doing do best, which is getting them that sort of privileged access to private places and people.
When you look at it, can a relatively small country like Ireland hold its own as a destination for these kinds of celebrities in terms of the kinds of things they want, the luxury that they want?
Yes, and the funny thing is luxury is something different to other people than it is necessary to ourselves. So, for example, we had a vice president of Exxon who's worth X amount of billions, and he was on a trip with us. He had done various trips with us, but we did one with him last year, and we do photographic journeys in Africa and Sri Lanka and places like that. But we actually did it on the Aran Islands, and he was staying in a 3-star hotel. He sent an email to us afterwards saying that it was the best trip he's ever done in his life. And he also said he never engaged as much on a holiday, on a vacation, as he did on that trip, because he was meeting local farmers, local fishermen, you know, local people were playing music for him. Award-winning musicians, you know, like traditional musicians of the year were playing music for him. Like, it's just he had access, you know, to something that he would never have. So luxury...
There's not much point getting a chauffeur-driven limo from the 3-star hotel over to the pier in the Aran Islands. It's a very different experience.
But the thing is, it's something like these people are in 5-star hotels all the time. So like another vice president of Apple we put into Caharnan Hotel, which, you know, was more like a 4-star rather than a 5-star down in Kerry. But they loved, that was the best, you know, hotel they stayed in when they were on their trip, because they're used to the St. Regis's and the Ritz-Carlton's. They want something unique. They want something authentic. You know, they don't want to just see and do when they travel. They want to feel and engage.
What about Americans today and Trump's America? Are they traveling in the same numbers? Do you find that they're perhaps a little bit more self-conscious about what's going on there when they go abroad?
Yes. So we saw a big dip in March and April. Now, it's come back up again because like January and February were the best January and February we've ever had. And I think June was our best June ever as well. But in March and April, there was a dip. And basically, a lot of Americans are worried about the perception abroad. And like we had to get a lot of, you know, newsletters out there to our clients saying, look, you know, you still got the Cate Mealfoilge in Ireland. Like, you know, we can't wait to see you. And then the other thing is that there was some advertising telling people to stay at home, like, you know, support the local economy, you know, stay in America. But to be honest, the type of clientele that we would have are people who want something different. They're more a discerning traveller.
Is it a very lucrative business?
Do you make as much money on regular clients as you would on celebrities? Like we had Kim and Kanye, and that broke my heart. I cried 4 times. That was very difficult because there was too many people, you know, in the middle, and you were dealing with 4 layers of travel agencies. So, you know, that was like, it takes years off your life when you got, you know, challenges with lots of people involved. Whereas if you're dealing with just a regular person who is spending, you know, 30 grand on a holiday, it's much easier.
As someone who's obviously travelled hugely around the world, and your own childhood and growing up and relationships you've had, are there still many places on your bucket list? Where would you really like to go that you haven't been?
I had paid some money for a Russian trade fair and it was caught when the war happened. My money was frozen in Russia. So they said, you know, well, why don't, if you want to use it up, the credit, we do events in Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan. So I went there in January and I loved the stands, as I called them. Uzbekistan in particular was just so interesting, and the food and everything, and they're good value. So I want to go back to Uzbekistan and go to Samarkand, because I read about the Silk Route when I was a child, and I've always wanted to go to Samarkand. And then I also want to go to Mongolia. But I want to keep on exploring Africa. Like, I haven't done all the countries in West Africa that I want to do. I love Uganda because it's such an affordable way to see the gorillas. And then Zimbabwe, fantastic value for safaris, for people who don't want to, you know, break the bank. And then South America I love as well. And the luxury lodges in Australia. They would be the ones that I want to do.
So after all of that travel, you still have a long bucket list there, Siobhan.
Oh, definitely.
You haven't lost any of that love of travel. Siobhan Byrne, owner and founder of Adams & Butler, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.